Thanks, Joe. So, as most of you have heard probably this morning, the Nobel Prize was awarded for the BC, so it's a good day to wear an Einstein shirt. It's also a good day to give a talk, for the same reason, it's a good day to give a talk about manipulation of ultra-cold atoms. As what I'm going to speak about today is a new tool for the manipulation of ultra-cold atoms, because the question always arises, okay, you have a BC, now what can you do with it? So, the exact title is the Atom Chip, which is the name of the new tool, and manipulation of ultra-cold atoms on nanofabricated surfaces. So this talk somehow relates to two of the programs that are running here. One is quantum computing, because this tool, we hope that it will enable quantum computing. And it also relates to the program on nanoscience, because the way that we manipulate the atoms is through traditional, one might say, solid state nanofabricated devices. Before going on, let me just mention briefly that a lot of people are working on this project. We now also have two new postdocs, and of course the head of the group, Jörg Schmidmeier. We have been until a year ago in Innsbruck, where a lot of the work has been already done, and we are now situated in Heidelberg, so the whole group moved to Heidelberg. Hi, Wojciech. okay, so a few words about the atom chip. This is how it looks like. So what you actually see here is a vacuum chamber flange. For those interested in details, it's a CF63. This flange goes into an ultra-high vacuum chamber where you can maintain, you know, the reasonable numbers, everything between 10 to the minus 10 millibar to 10 to the minus 12. And so you see here also ultra-high vacuum feed-through, where you can send currents into the vacuum chamber. These currents or voltages go up to this place here, and here is where the chip is located. So this chip is actually a thin layer of gold, which is evaporated on some substrate, whatever it is, silicon, gallium arsenide, whatever. So it's a very thin layer of gold, about 1 micron, in which one fabricates all kinds of wires and designs, and I'll show you all of them. So we have all kinds of wires on this surface, and we're connected to these wires. Here you see the connections on both sides, so the currents that come from outside the chamber go and flow through the wires on the chip, and right above the chip we have atoms, neutral atoms, that are hovering a few microns above the surface, because the neutral atoms need the environment, need the ultra high vacuum environment to survive. So we have them hovering a few microns above the surface, not as in usual nano science, as we saw yesterday, electrons run within the surface. Here we have atoms running above the surface. They're running within the potentials that we build out of the electric fields and magnetic fields that come from the currents and the charges that run inside the wires fabricated on the chip. So I guess I hope this is understood, and we can go forward, look in more detail. Okay, what do we actually want to do with this tool? This tool, by the way, is quite new. It's 2 years, I think, since the first papers came. So I wrote here a quantum tool box that can do everything. And what do I mean by everything? I wrote preparing, manipulation, and measuring complex quantum states. And being able to do that by tailoring a complicated and accurate, by tailoring complicated and accurate potentials. So you have your atoms, and now you want to be able to design whatever potentials you want, multi-minima potentials, specific tunneling barriers, specific interferometers, and so on. You want to tailor those potentials to do the specific experiment that you want, just like we saw yesterday in Amir's talk about how they tailor their exact wires to do the specific experiment that they want, in that case, one-dimensional potentials. Okay, so let me go a little bit through a checklist, or actually a wish list, of what one can hopes to be able to do with this new tool. So, decoherence. Decoherence is, you know, a topic that one can still do a lot of experiments on, and here again we hope that because we can build superpositions or have complex potentials, we can learn and have very specific environments, because the system is well isolated and you can really choose the environment that will act upon it. We hope that nice experiments with decoherence could be done. Just to give you an example, just take a double well potential and perform a superposition of atoms of a BC and work with an external with some external coupling to see when that superposition, spatial superposition, collapses. Okay. Another very interesting issue that we know very little about is surface-induced effects. So you have a nanokelvin system sitting a micron above a room temperature surface. What happens there? People know very little about it, and this is exactly the system that can give some answers. There are also very interesting questions about technical noise, such as the noise that runs within the wires from the current drivers, and so on. Nonlinearity. You know that BC is a nonlinear system, and we think that within these complicated potentials, one will be able to learn a lot about them. There are just some papers coming out now about whether or not what will happen in mean field. What happens when you take a BC and you actually split it in a beam splitter? Okay, and nobody really knows, and there is some nice theory looking into that. Of course, a lot of very nice things in terms of atom light, cavity QD experiments. You could really bring the experiment to be on the level of a single atom, single photon experiment, to really look into that interaction. Chaos. You can have multipath interferometers that will realize chaotic systems. Entanglement, which actually is very much connected to nonlinearity because it's atom-atom interaction. There are a lot of things about atom interaction that we don't know, and experiments cannot be done today. And we hope that this tool will be able to do them. For example, how does the scattering length of atoms change when the potential, the external potential that confines them, the trap, is on the same length as the scattering potential? What happens there? Another thing is to check higher orders of atom-atom interaction. For example, if you manage to throw away the dipole-dipole 1 over R cubed interaction, you're left with 1 over R interaction, which people have not been able to see. So there are a lot of subtle, delicate experiments that could be done. And last but not least, low dimensional physics. We saw yesterday one dimensional wires in Amir Jacobi's talk. Here, one dimensional BECs and two dimensional, that means flat gases, are very interesting systems that people would like to investigate. In terms of applications, of course, a lot of these things are now in the titles or looked upon by many people. So you have quantum communications, that are actually some systems are already being built. What Atom Chip will be able to do is to put in a missing piece of the puzzle, and that is the conversion from a flying qubit to a storage qubit. Flying qubit are the photons that run inside the fibers. Storage qubit is something that could hold the qubit for a long time somewhere in a specific localized area without decohering. Of course, quantum computing, I put here Peter Zoller because he did, his group did most of the work that we follow. And a lot of work needs to be done and to follow the theoretical predictions of theoretical work. For example, how do you load single atoms into traps? So there is a phase transition that one expects to see, whereby a BC will really send single atoms into specific minimas, and you need that to do quantum computation. There are very interesting quantum gates, that's two qubit operations, collision gates, Rydberg gates, Coulomb blockade gates, cavity QED gates. There's a lot of theoretical thought out there, but no one can really realize that until you have an accurate tool with which to do the experiments, and we hope that the Atom Chip indeed will be able to do these experiments. So that's the wish list, and how do you hope to do that? So first of all, of course, you take a neutral atom, which is a well-isolated system. It, of course, couples weakly with its environment. Inside the potentials, it has two more advantages. There is, in some of the atoms, you have very little inelastic scattering, atom-atom inelastic scattering, which you need for coherent propagation, and you don't have inelastic scattering with the potential. It's a conservative potential, and so in that sense, this system really looks nice in order to do the job. You also have well-established control of external and internal degrees of freedom. That's from the work of people like Bill Phillips and Stephen Chu that got the Nobel for that in 97. And you have also, we tip into the well-established miniaturization techniques of nanoscience. So let me try and describe what we've done until today. First, a brief word about our collaborators in Europe. Actually, there is now a collaboration that is aimed at building the Atom Chip in Europe. And we're the coordinators of that collaboration. It's called ACQUIRE, Atom Chips for Quantum Information Research. And if you want more details about the work of the different groups, you just look for ACQUIRE on the web. Okay, basics. So, before I go into the basic physics, let me just very briefly look at the history of how the thought came about to build an atom chip. So magnetic manipulation with a magnetic moment of an atom, you can go back to Stern-Gerlach. After that, there was, in 32, I found a nice paper that actually talks about one wire, a magnetic minima, with just using one wire and a magnetic field. In a minute, I'll show you how that works. A proposal in 61 by Vladimirsky to manipulate neutrons with current-carrying wires. Then several people, starting with Jeffrey Oppat from the University of Melbourne in the 90s, thought of how to build atom mirrors. So surfaces where atoms, that's the first time that surfaces have actually been thought of that. So you just have a surface and you want atom to come down and bounce back again. So these are atom mirrors that have either permanent magnets on them or a magnetic field that come from current carrying wires. Jörg Schmidmayr started to work in 92 in MIT on wire experiments with atoms. These were freestanding wires, not on atom chips. Then in 95, there was an interesting paper, the first proposal to do it on a surface, nanofabricated surface by Weinstein and Liebrecht. I think they were in Caltech at the time. And they showed the potential of these miniaturized surfaces. And then the first surface mot, I will explain what a MOT is in a minute, but the first experiments that managed to collect atoms above a surface have been performed. Korea, Germany, the Munich group did a very nice chip mod in 1999 that we use today. And then the first paper that really uses the phrase atom chip but also has some of the basic elements, which means some complex manipulation was done on the chip for the atoms, plus the fabrication method that was used. The limit of the fabrication method was smaller than the de Broglie wavelength of the atoms, which really means you can have control at the phase level. That appeared in 2000, then the Quire collaboration came, and as you know perhaps, just a few weeks ago, or actually last week, two papers came out with the first BC on an atom chip. And these experiments showed us that you can go to a few microns above the surface and the BC still has a long lifetime. So you have that nano-Kelvin system sitting a few microns above the room temperature surface with long lifetimes, which is of course very encouraging for us. And currently, as far as I know, at least six labs around the world are building atom chips. Okay, that's as far as history goes. By the way, feel free really to interrupt. I mean, this is really an informal presentation in that sense. What are the interactions? So, I'll talk mainly about two interactions, which is the magnetic interaction and the electric interaction. Although the range is wider. People also use, for example, light on surfaces, and I'll just touch upon some of the issues briefly, but I'll mainly concentrate on the electric interaction and the magnetic interaction. So the magnetic interaction, how do you get a minimum out of a current carrying wire? You want a minimum because that's how you trap the atom. The atom has a magnetic moment and it's either a weak field seeker or a strong field seeker, depending on if its magnetic moment is with the field or is parallel to the field or anti-parallel to the field, because the interaction is just mu dot B, okay? So if you have a minimum in your magnetic field, the strong field seekers will run out, the weak field seekers will run in, so half of your atoms will run to the minimum of the magnetic field. And to get a minimum, all you have to do is to take a wire, run a current through it, and you get these magnetic lines around it, okay? And you see the fields around? You add a homogeneous bias field. These are just lines, okay? The surface is here, and the wire is just on the surface. So you just add a homogeneous bias field that is parallel to the surface, and what you get is a cancellation of the field of the wire exactly at one point, and that is that point where you have a minimum a few microns above the surface, above the wire. So this is how you get it. Here you see it somehow nicer. So this is the wire. The wire runs up on this thing, and here you have the minimum alongside the wire. Again, this is simulation, a classical simulation. You have a wire, and you have the atom trajectories along the minimum. The electric interaction is quite similar. The electric interaction is attractive, where alpha here is the polarizability of the atom. Even a neutral atom can, of course, interact with the electric field. It doesn't have to have charge. The interaction, of course, is much weaker. And if you put an atom, a neutral atom, in a electric field E, you get a potential that is half alpha E squared, an attractive potential. And of course, then they will crash to the surface, because if you have only an attractive potential, the atoms will just attract until they crash into the wire. And so if you put that, you have to put that wire on a repulsive potential, and that repulsive potential is being produced by an atomic mirror, an atom mirror, which I will not go into, but if somebody later asks me, I will explain how an atom mirror works. But in principle, you have exponentially decaying magnetic field, so the weak field seekers do not want to go onto the surface. And if you add this exponentially decaying potential from the mirror with the attractive potential from the from the wire, from the charge carrying wire, you get this minimum above the surface. So this is the surface, and here you have the minimum. Okay? And here you see the height in microns. So this specific example has a height of 6 microns above the surface. And you can, for example, do a beam splitter. So you just take your charged wire and you split your charged wire into 2 wires, and you follow the minimum of the potential and you see how it splits into 2 guides. That's a beam splitter. Now, people have done with these things many different, they have many different different ways to exploit it. For example, an atom mirror doesn't have to be magnetic. You can just have a blue detuned light, evanescent wave blue detuned light that comes from the bottom, and that is enough to repulse the atoms. There are a lot of mirrors that are being built in that way. Instead of current carrying wires, you can use permanent magnets. A lot of ideas are going around, but as I said, I will try and focus only on some of them. Okay. How do you get 3D confinement? So as I showed you before in the previous transparency, if you just take a wire, run a current through it, and you run a homogeneous field, you get a minimum, okay? At this point where the homogeneous field exactly cancels at some distance from the wire, the field from the wire. But we want also to do 3D. This gives you a guide, a 2D confinement. But if you want to do a 3D confinement, so there are several options to do that. You can just take your wire and bend it. And these bendings, if you look at the fields that these end caps do, what happens is that you get a minimum which is 3D, and as the atom goes towards the bends, he sees a stronger and stronger field, and now you get the same field in this direction, but you also get a confinement in the other direction. We call that end caps. You can also bend it in the other direction. That's very interesting. If you bend it like this, in the minimum, you get a quadrupole-like trap with a zero at the minimum. If you bend it like this, you get what's called a Joffe-Pritchard type of trap, which has a non-zero in the minimum. So you have, from very simple configurations, you can get very different traps. Later I'll explain what is there are basic differences in how the atoms behave in a trap like this and a trap like this. For this we call the Z-trap. I'll refer it later as the Z-trap, and this we call the U-trap. And here you can see an example of how the minimum looks in a Z-trap. So you see the minimum from one direction, and you see the minimum from a top view. Okay? It's interesting to think how this is reconciled with the Earnshaw theorem, because the Earnshaw theorem actually says, I see some people smiling at that, because the Earnshaw theory actually says that you cannot have this minimum, 3D minimum. And if you look carefully at what happens here, you find that this 3D minimum is actually a minimum of modulus of B and not of the field, the vectorial field. And it's just because the atom magnetic moment follows, it's a adiabatic motion, so he follows, he manages to stay anti-parallel to the field, so he has to change his magnetic moment direction as he goes around the trap, that this actually works without contradicting the Earnshaw theorem. So it's not a static problem. The system actually adapts itself to the trap. Okay, I'll start showing you results from 99 to now, but the first thing that perhaps I should show is that I always like to show that we moved, and that move took us a whole year. It takes a year to move. So this is our lab in Innsbruck. This is how our lab was on the truck, and this is how we found the labs in Heidelberg. We had to work very hard to get them into shape. This is how Innsbruck looks, just above the university, and this is the picture from the university at Heidelberg. So, okay. So, fabrication. We had to adopt the fabrication processes, the nanofabrication processes, this publication actually is done in the Weizmann Institute, to our special needs. But I would like to go with you again on the motivation of using nanofabrication processes. So the first motivation is miniaturization, okay? And the first idea behind miniaturization is the following. Until now, how was BEC manipulated? Okay, BEC is manipulated with magnetic fields, also in a magnetic trap, magnetic minima, from coils that are outside the chamber. This means that you cannot get complexity or accuracy of your trap on the scale smaller than the distance to your coils. Okay, as you go in and you come closer with your sources of magnetic fields, you can make them much smaller because of the same reason, and therefore that was the first motivation. So you want to have accuracy on the de Broglie wavelength scale of the atoms, and for that you have to go very close with the sources of your magnetic fields to be able to do such potentials. Another thing that you want to have is you want to have very small control over, once you have control over very small distances with these very accurate potentials, you can have interactions that are on nanometer scale. Okay, for example, if you want to have controlled collisions for entanglement between atoms, you really have to have the distances between two localized atoms at a nanometer scale between them. That again you can only have if you manage to do potentials on that scale, individual 3D potentials on that scale. We want to have smaller and smaller wires, and the reason for that is that if you have, let's say, a 100 micron wide wire, again you will not be able to get the trap, the minimum of the trap, lower than the size of the wire without that trap degrading, because the trap wants to see a singularity, it wants to see an infinitely small wire, okay, for the calculations to be valid that I showed you before. But the minute you start having finite size effect because your wires are wide, then this has to be quite high, the trap, in order to feel that this is an infinitely small wire. And we don't want them. We want to take them closer and closer to the surface, because as you go closer to the surface, your trap frequencies, your traps become tighter, your trap frequencies become higher. You can do a manipulation on a much smaller scale because your ground state sizes become smaller and smaller. So we want smaller and smaller wires. So right now we're already working with 1 micron wires, but we hope to go very quickly to 100 nanometer wires as the sources of the fields. Another reason not to use freestanding wires as been used in the 90s is you want a heat sink. You want something that will be able to extract the heat from the wires, otherwise they burn. Robustness comes to the same thing. Scalability, it's very hard with freestanding structures to do scalability. Let's say you do want to do quantum computing. You want to have arrays of traps. In each trap you have a qubit. You want to have multiple arrays of traps, and that we call scalability, and that you can only do with a nanofabricated system. 3D structures, you want to have multiple layers of traps, so multiple layers of wires, because for example, if you just want to have a wire crossing without two wires touching, you have to have multi-layers, and nanofabrication can provide that. And last, we also want to have light elements, such as cavity QED or lenses or fibers and so on, integrated into the system. Again, it will provide you with very accurate control over the light atom interaction, and that you can do presently more and more with photonics, which is solid state devices for light manipulation. So we hope that all these different things will eventually bring us to have an integrated system with which we can really go down to small scales and have all the needs like light elements on there. Currently, we have current densities, we see very high current densities in our wire. We can drive more than 10 to the 7 amp per centimeter square, very high voltages before we have a breakdown. And we need that for the electric trapping that I showed you before. We're starting to build light elements on the chip, as I'll show you later, and we're starting with multi-layer designs. Here you see a 1 micron wire. This is a liftoff process. This is the photoresist just before it's taken off. So this is a 1 by 1 square, so the atoms hover a few microns above this wire. Here you see a picture of the top picture of the chip. So you see the whole chip is actually gold. This is gold, this is gold, this is gold, this is gold. And we define the wires by just taking 10 micron wide valleys. We're making 10 micron wide etchings where the gold is removed. So you see this is an etching here, and this is an etching, and this is an etching. Otherwise, it's all gold, and this defines the wire. Okay? You see here an example of burnt wire. When we go over this density, then the wire burns, and there we also see very interesting effects. There are different regimes of burning. We've not researched that in detail, but this will be important to look into as we put we go to smaller and smaller structures. Okay, back to atoms. So how do atoms interact with the atom chip? The first thing you have to do is to collect them from some source. You have, for example, an atomic beam. What is an atomic beam? You just have some oven, you throw in a piece of metal. It could be any alkali, for example, lithium, rubidium, and you heat it up. You heat it up so from the surface of this 1 millimeter cube piece of metal, atoms start going out. And you have a little hole at the end of the oven, let's say a 1 millimeter hole, and you get a beam of atoms coming out of that hole. That's a thermal beam. They're very fast. You have to slow them down. You have to collect them somewhere above the chip to have high densities of atoms. And that you do with something that is called a MOT. That's a magnetical optical trap. And what it does is actually, with the help of magnetic fields that give you a quadrupole configuration just above the chip. This is the center of the quadrupole configuration. This is done by external quadrupole coils. And with light beams, you get a force that cools them. And I refer you again to the 97 Nobel Prize. And not only cools them, but confines them spatially to one position. This is the MOT. You get here a cloud of, let's say, 1 million atoms. It could be also 10 to the 9 atoms. And these atoms are immediately cooled without any other effort to microkelvin temperatures. So you have a cloud, an initial cloud of atoms in microkelvin temperatures hovering, let's say 2 millimeters above the surface of the chip, which you see here. And the first big problem was a normal MOT, as was done in the 90s by many people, has beams also coming from the bottom, because you need light forces from all directions to be able to really work and confine those atoms. But the minute you put a chip surface, you cannot have light coming from the bottom. So you had to find a solution for that, and the solution was to actually use the surface of the chip as a mirror. And you trick the atoms to think that they also have two light beams coming from the bottom by the fact that these beams coming from the top reflect, and the atoms feel that they also have light pressure from the bottom. And the trick is also the helicities of the light are very important, and I won't go into detail, but the thing works just because of the fact that the helicity of the photons is changed upon reflection. You see here the chip surface. You see here the MOT. It's this cloud of atoms. You can see it by eye for lithium, for example. Question? Yeah. That's a great question. You see shadows of those etchings on the MOT, and those shadows, of course, reduce the number of atoms. It's all a game of some people cover those etchings. They do a passivation layer, and on top of that, they do a perfect mirror. And comparison between those perfect mirrors and without the perfect mirror with the etchings show that it's not that bad, as long as the etchings are really small and not too dense. So we have these cloud of atoms. As I said, you can see it by eye. It's really beautiful to see a cloud of atoms by eye just because of the their line, okay, the atomic transition, if it's in the visible, then you just see their fluorescence by eye. That's how we see the atoms. We shine in a flash of light, or let's say a millisecond, and look and wait until the atoms reflect that light, they absorb it, and after that there's of course spontaneous emission, and that's what you see. And or for other atoms, alkalis like rubidium, it's in the near infrared, so then you have to use some apparatus to give you the picture. And you see here the vacuum chamber. This is a window of the vacuum chamber, and you see the atom chip. It's the same, exactly the same chip. You see it mounted in there. You see the gold surface up there, and this is how a full experiment looks like. This is how it looks like now in Heidelberg, where you see this same window right here. And you could see that there are a lot of coils around, because it's really important to compensate for all magnetic fields of Earth or come from the lab and things of that nature. It's very small. I mean, you see here a multimeter, so the thing is pretty small. It's, I mean, from here to here, it's like this. The size of the condensate, I'll come later to a BC, which we're also working on, or hopefully we'll have soon, but I mean, the BCs that have been achieved in the past weeks, the Munich one is 6,000 atoms, which is small. You have to remember also that it was done in a very bad vacuum. It's the first time that a BC is done in a bad vacuum. They showed that you don't need a double mod system. In one mod system, with 10 to the minus 9, which is extremely bad vacuum, they got their BC, which was a great achievement. Not only that, instead of having several tens of seconds of cooling, because of the high compression, they could do the whole BC in 700 milliseconds. But afterwards, I'll talk a little bit about BCs. I don't want to go into that. But the size, they had to pay with the size, and to your question, it was 6,000 atoms. The other BC experiment on a chip had 10 to the 5.
And
the size is it goes with the ground state of your trap, and of course the ground states are much smaller. Okay, but you can, this is something that you can change at will on an atom chip. You can decide whatever aspect ratio you want for the BC and whatever ground state size you want. Okay, going back to our I think we have finalized this transparency. Okay, now that we have a mot above the chip, now we really want to take the atoms and start going down to the surface, okay? As I said, you want to go down to the surface because your traps become tighter and tighter, and your level spacing larger and larger, and that's where you hope to have the coherent control over the atoms. So, here you still see the light is on. Of course, all the manipulations on an atom chip are dark. There's no light. Okay, the initial mot needs light, as you saw, and you see here a top view of the atom chip. You see here the connections to from the outside wires to the chip, and you see here the mot, a top mot. So here's the cloud just above the center of the chip, and now until now you had no currents anywhere on the chip. It was all done just like in the normal BC experiment from coils on the outside of the chamber. Now we start pushing. The red indicates current. We start pushing current through wires that are either on the chip or slightly below the chip, just like in this case. And we stop the coils. We stop any use of coils from the outside, of the quadrupole coils, I mean. And we now have a mot that actually comes from a quadrupole field from a U-trap. You remember I showed you before a U-trap? And this thing, it's beautiful to see that actually if you take a wire and you put it into a U-shape, you get a 3D quadrupole field, which is very nice. And so with the same light configuration, you still have a mot, but this mot is now well aligned on the center of the chip. It does not use the big coils that are far away. And then you cut off the light, and here for the first time you have a U, a quadrupole, magnetic trap, because there's no longer any light forces. So now you lose half of the atoms. We spoke of weak field seekers and strong field seekers, depending on where you caught the atom. And if the magnetic moment of the atom was parallel or anti-parallel, it will decide if it goes away from the trap or goes towards the minimum. And here we see the atoms that went toward the minimum. Okay, so we now see a top view and a side view. You see here two clouds, by the way, because the bottom cloud is just a reflection from the perfect mirror, the gold mirror of the surface of the chip. And then you start going, you zoom in and you go further and further down. These atoms, you see here 10,000 atoms hovering 10 microns above the surface of the chip. And you see the reflection down there. And already in these early experiments, by the way, down here, they're already in a Z configuration, in a Z trap. So I also showed you before a Z trap. And here they were already in a ground state size of 100 nanometer and 100 kilohertz trapping frequencies, which already are a big improvement over what you can do with external coils. Okay, now a few issues of compression. This is very technical, so I won't go into it in detail. But as you compress them, you have a lot of things to worry about. For example, here we show in a number of atoms, so this is actually a lifetime fit of what happens to the trap. This is a compressed trap, meaning we took them highly down to the surface and they were extremely compressed. The density of atoms was large, and this is a non-compressed trap. And we fit it to a function that has to do with background gas collisions, which is just a function of the number of atoms in the trap. N is the number of atoms in the trap. And N square is a function that tells you about the two atom-atom collisions. That is a function of N square, and you could see a very strong enhancement of the two body collisions in once you, which is down here, and then it goes toward the normal exponential that comes from this term. And you could see that as you compress them, you have to start worrying about atom-atom interaction that may flip the spins and therefore send them out of the trap, and that's why you see this loss of number of atoms. Once you take them down to the surface, you also start to worry about surface-induced decoherence. And here are calculations that were done in the Martin Wilkins group in Potsdam. They've published several works on this, on how, as a function of height, here you see 1 micron height above the surface, the loss rate will go higher as you go down towards very low heights. And that has to do with the fact that the spins flip because of magnetic fluctuations that come from virtual currents, thermally induced virtual currents in the room temperature surface of your chip. So there's a lot of physics that is being calculated, and there's not enough experimental data at this stage to know how accurate it is. But as I said, a few weeks ago, they took the BC down to 30 microns without destroying it. So it looks like the calculations are right in saying that the system is viable in that sense. The lifetimes will be long enough before the spin flips to do a lot of operations in the several millisecond regime in terms of time. Where are we now? In terms of compression, we got all the way down to 6 micron height above the surface. And you do that with only 100 milliamp current. So you have to try and compare it to what people did before that. To get something in that scale of a 10 nanometer ground size, people would have to use, from the coils outside the chambers, hundreds of amps to get anything close to that. And we're doing the same thing, or better, with 100 milliamp. And the ground state size, as you can see, is already extremely slow, and the gradients are huge. You can actually not get such gradients when you work from far away. Okay. Some of the early chip experiments that were done. So once you have the atoms down there, you can start flowing current through several wires at once. For example, we have here a Z-trap, but as you can remember from the basics, a Z-wire also needs a homogeneous field. So we can produce the homogeneous field by having just two U-shaped wires running co-propagating currents. They produce a homogeneous field just above the wire. So this is a self-sufficient chip where all the coils from outside have been turned on. Or you can show a 2D confinement. So instead of having the end cap, you just open the current to run along the chip, And here you see that just thermally, with thermal velocity, the atoms propagate along the guide. So this picture is a top view of this guide. Or you can show continuous loading. We have a 3D trap here, and we open a little hole. We can control a little hole in that trap into a guide, and we can deplete it, deplete this trap continuously at any rate we want into such a guide. The next thing, of course, that one wants to do is try and copy elements of light optics, for example, a beam splitter. We want to really have everything that you have on an optical table, we want to be able to have on a chip, instead of light optics, to do it with matter wave optics, right? So, for example, you take a very simple beam splitter that you just do by the fact that you take a single wire and you split the wire. So these are current carrying wires. And you see here that we can actually let the atoms, and these again are fluorescence images of the atoms. This is lithium-7 in this case. And so everything is dark, and then you send in a flash of half a millisecond or a millisecond of light, and then you see them. And you see that you can tell them to go right, you can tell them to go left, you can tell them to go in both in any ratio, split ratio that you want, and with any, also with any compression that you want. You see that this is less compressed. You see here the width of the trap. This is less compressed than this one, and also the splitting, therefore, changes. This is how potential of such a beam splitter looks like. Again, above the chip. The chip surface is down here, and these are the wires that create this potential.
These pictures are destructive or non-destructive?
These pictures are very destructive.
I do not understand how can you choose between the left and right?
Simply by sending the current with different ratios. You can send the current only through this one or through this one or through both. That's what will create the potential, and the atoms will see either one guide or two guides or guides with different openings. Okay, this is of course number splitting. This is not coherent splitting. And in a minute I'll talk about coherent splitting. So any more questions about the beam splitter? Okay.
Well, it's number splitting because this beam is so wide, right? The gap goes either left or right.
This is number splitting simply because I cannot prove it's coherent splitting, but it could be that it's already coherent splitting.
But these are like multimode fibers.
These right now are like multimode fibers, exactly. I hope to show you in a few transparencies that you can actually get coherent splitting here also with multimode propagation. Okay, so back to your question, in terms of multimode, I would say that several hundred levels are now occupied, okay? Again, once you put a BC there, immediately that changes into a multimode fiber. So, you asked about coherence, and this is the name of the game. So, the first thing to prove coherence of this beam splitter is to put another beam splitter back-to-back to it and try and see an interference pattern. So that's what we're doing now. Unfortunately, I still don't have pictures of an interference pattern for you. I just have calculations. There is a quant phase that has all these calculations, so I'm not going to go into detail about them unless you ask me to. What happens here, you see the two, we call it the Y beam splitter, okay? Because you just have an incoming port and two outgoing ports. It's nice, by the way, to see that not only we use the same fabrication methods that are used for electron potentials in the work like Amir is doing, but we're using the same configuration of the beam splitter as was used in the electron interferometers that were done at Weizmann. So this looks very much like an electron interferometer, where you have a Y beam splitter, and you see here the incoming port, and you see here the barrier going up slowly. And what happens to the different wave functions, if you just look at the ground state, of course, if a ground state comes in, it will go into two ground states of your split potential. Okay, and now if you apply pi phase shift to one of the ground states, you'll get this, still in the ground state, but with a pi phase shift. And now if you connect them at your outport, at the second beam splitter, which is a recombiner, you of course expect it to go into your first excited state. Okay? So this is an interesting mechanism, actually, through which we think that this thing here at the end will show a multimode interference pattern. And I'll try very briefly to try and convince you why. Okay, so this is the longitudinal interference pattern. This is just the intensity of the atoms. We hope to look with our flash here and to see this density modulation of the atoms. And what happens actually is the following. What you have is many, many modes. This is the transverse levels of the incoming guide. These are the levels within the interferometer, and these are the levels in the outward guide. And what you actually have is the following. If you try and convince yourself what happens to any transverse level coming in, I just showed you the ground state. The ground state coming in goes into two ground states, okay? And this is this thing. Now, it doesn't matter if you come in the ground state or the first excited state. If you come in the first excited state, it splits into two ground states, one with a pi phase shift. So it came like this, and it goes like this, two ground states with a pi phase shift. Okay, and if you do nothing, it will come back to its original first excited state. So they will come here, split in, go into two ground states with a pi phase shift, and go up back here. If you take a ground state, it will split into two ground states with no phase shift between them, and go back to ground state in the guide. If you do something like do a pi phase shift here, it will come from here, go up here, and go up here. The same will happen for every couple of transverse modes. Every couple of even and odd transverse modes you actually have here, many disjoint interferometers that don't talk to each other. This is in 2D, I remind you. In 3D, it's much more complicated. But 2D systems have been we are able to realize them. And so what would happen? What would happen is if you do a pi phase shift to a ground state that comes in here, and it has to go because of the pi phase shift up here, it loses h bar omega from where? From its kinetic energy, longitudinal kinetic energy, because it needed an h bar omega kick in the transverse energy, and that would slow it down. So this slowing down or enhancing the velocity, because if this guy, because of a pi phase shift, goes down here, it gets a kick in the longitudinal velocity, h bar omega, to go faster. And eventually, all these things will form this modulation in the density of atoms at the end. And the modulation is exactly the same for all these disjoint interferometers. And therefore, it just adds incoherently. If you start with a thermal source here. If you start with a thermal source with just an incoherent sum of your transverse states, you at the end add incoherently all these guys, but they look exactly the same, so the total output will be just like that. Just a second before that, I show you here a simulation of a ground state coming in, splitting, getting a pi phase shift, and you see it coming out as the first excited state, which is just what I explained here. And here you have the same simulation, but also for intermediate phase shift, for example, 3/2 pi phase shift, and you see that if you come in with a ground state, you actually get some of them go into a first excited state and some of them remain in the ground state. But if you look from the side, which is what we're doing here, you integrate over your transverse length, you see that you have here a modulation of the intensity of the atoms.
So then the patterns are the same. That's because you assume the harmonic confinement in the outgoing wire, right?
Yes. Yeah. So anyhow, this unharmonicity is bad, very bad. And how much bad? We're calculating.
This level diagram that you have on the lower left, having trouble counting the number of energy levels, I would expect there to be twice as many in the region where you have, where after it splits off. and yet I'm assuming that there's a degenerate.
Yes.
If they're the same number of levels, would you have one when you have two of these wires? Why is that?
I'm not sure I understand what you mean, what you have here.
For a given energy, you add up the number of levels of a certain energy.
Right.
If you just take a square well and you make it twice as wide, you'll get twice as many energy levels.
Right. Ah, okay. That's very important. Okay. The frequencies are, of course, different. At the end, you'll get the same number of levels. But if you look just as a function of energy, yeah? Let's just take an example, one example. Let's say this, the frequency is double the frequency in the incoming guide. So the frequency here in this region is double the frequency here. You see? Okay? So, how is it double? That's very simple for us to do. That's very simple for us. That's very simple for us to do. You just compress more. Let me just show you. Even in the simple beam splitter, the frequency is double. Because you see that it's much more compressed after the splitting. So once the frequency is double, I have no problem. So what will happen is that if this is the incoming energy, then this energy will be somewhere between this one and this one.
So the wire has a different shape, you're saying, after it's split off?
No. In this case, the wire just has half the current. And half the current makes double the compression because the current is split. But there are many other ways to do the to change the frequency as at will, as you want. Okay. Ah, this modulation, okay, again, it depends on your experimental parameters, but we use here parameters that we actually have in the experiment, and you get here a periodicity of actually 500 microns, which is huge. Okay? By the way, this will smear out, of course. This all comes about because you have a pulse source. If you have a CW source, you're dead. And also the size of your source has to be smaller than your periodicity, and our sources are around 100 microns right now, so it's definitely a point source for this experiment. Okay, let's try and continue. Now, the actual beam splitters that are now being used in the experiment, and they're already in the chamber. Here you see the design of two different beam splitters, two different interferometers that have been already fabricated at Weizmann, and they're now in the chamber. One is an interferometer. You see here the two paths of the interferometer. Okay, this is the gold island in the middle. I won't go into a detailed description of all the wires. It's not important. What's important is that out of the interferometer, you see that there is only one wire going out. There's one port. So this goes to the interferometer I was explaining before. So you have beam splitters. Also here, there is one port. You have one port incoming, one port outgoing. This is the interferometer I've been explaining before. Another thing. You see here several wires simply because we have made the design of the wires for the beam splitter better than it was before. It was one wire going into two wires. Now it's two wires going into two wires. I won't go into details. Okay? So this is what we call an improved three-port beam splitter. The main advantage, by the way, of this configuration is that the height doesn't change. The height of the surface, which we like very much. Here you have an electric lead. We put here voltage just to do the pi phase shift or any phase shift that we want with the atoms. So this is our modulator. On one of the paths you have an electric lead, which you can just with a few volts, it's enough to get any modulation that you want. Another type of interferometer that we want to try, but this is a single mode now, this would not work with multi-mode, is a Mach-Zehnder type of interferometer where you need two inputs and two outputs. So you see this is the end of the interferometer and it goes into two outputs. And at the point of the splitting, now you have four ports. This is a beam splitter with a four port and it works on tunneling. You have a tunneling barrier in the center. So when atom comes, he sees a tunneling barrier with a 50-50% tunneling probability and he's split coherently into the two paths. There he also gains a phase difference between the transmitted and the reflected parts of the wave function, and this is really becoming similar to what you have in your optical cube on your table when you deal with photons. You have a pi over 2 phase shift between the reflected and the transmitted photon, and that's what you'll have here. And in a Mach-Zehnder interferometer that all of us know, the interference comes just because of this pi over 2 phase shift between the transmitted and the reflected, if you don't do anything in the arms. And therefore, we hope here to see with this similar phase shift that in the beam splitter, we're doing nothing in the arms, that at the end, we'll get occupation of atoms only in one of the arms, just like you get in a Mach-Zehnder interferometer. So this is, the second type is, of course, only for a BEC. Well, the first type will be attempted with a thermal source. Oh, what?
Pulsed,
but thermal. You know, thermal in terms of all transverse levels are filled. It's important to have the pulse in order to see it. Yeah. Okay. So let me show you now another thing that we're going for. Until now, all the magnetic configurations I showed you needed a horizontal bias field parallel to the surface of the chip. We had one wire and we had a horizontal bias field. So this is my surface. I have one wire and I have a horizontal bias field. Okay? This is very problematic because your atoms can only go one direction on the chip. Why? Because if you change the direction of your wire, the magnetic lines, the homogeneous bias field is no longer 90 degrees to the wire. And if you draw it at home, you'll see that you no longer get the minimum that you want. So actually, you're limited to one dimensional thing on your chip, which is not nice. We want to be able to have a real fiber, like an optical fiber, but for matter waves, that can go anywhere on the chip, any direction. This also, by the way, you should have now asked, how can you do a beam splitter that you showed us before if you say that you cannot go in any direction you want because the wires go in some angle? And the answer is, yes, we can only do very small opening angle beam splitters with this configuration of single wires and homogeneous bias field. If you want to do big area interferometers, as people, for example, would want to do to have, you know, acceleration sensors, then you want to have a large area, and then you really need a fiber. You need something that acts like a photon fiber for matter waves that can go in any direction on the chip. And this is this project. Wow, a few minutes, that's... Okay, so we call it the atom fiber, but that has to do simply with the fact that you use several wires and you use a vertical bias field. The minute you use a vertical bias field, really, you can go anywhere you want, and the bias field is still perpendicular to your wire, as you want. You always want your bias field to be perpendicular to the wire. And then you can do, really, with these two wire configuration, big angle beam splitters. There are a lot of technical details about the number of states that you fill in these guides, but I'm not going to go into them. Right now, we don't have time for that. Let me just show you some experimental pictures. This is a design that was already realized. And just to show that we really have a fiber, we drew a spiral. It could be anything, but we drew a spiral. We were creative. And you see the spiral here in a real picture inside the chamber. We load the atoms. This is the loading. You remember from the initial MOT, we go down. So you see the spiral here from a side view, and you see how the atoms with the reflection from the mirror, you see them going down. Here you see them already really localized, 50 microns above the chip, ready to go into the spiral. Okay, this is your fiber. And very preliminary results that we have. Unfortunately, this was done only in the past few weeks. Without a vertical field, you see them going straight out of the trap. Once you open it with a vertical field, you see them taking the bend. What is that?
The code.
Sorry. White is highest intensity, okay? Red, lower intensity. Blue and green, very low intensity. So this white is where the atoms are. This white here is where the atoms are, white and red. So you see them following the curve. And we also tried to push them, again, this very preliminary efforts, and you see them here without pushing, so you see the atoms going along the spiral, and here we start to push them, so instead of many of the atoms, because if it's just a thermal distribution, Lontunian thermal distribution, then the center of mass is always in the front, in the back, stays in the back, but if you push them with some gradient, you see that the center of mass moves forward, and here's a zoom to the bottom of the spiral, and you see the trail of the atoms, like some rocket, and here is the center of mass of the atoms down there. And since I have to really go quickly, anybody interested can ask me later. Let me just flash at you. We're now putting in also electric traps. This is another degree of freedom, as I explained before, that is very nice to have. You can do the famous quantum collision gate for quantum computation that came from Tommaso Colalco. In his 2000 PRA, you want to have two atoms and you want to be able to entangle them by collision, and so you want to have a barrier here that you can take down and up at will between the atoms, and this we can do with this additional degree of freedom. This is one motivation. Another motivation is you want to be able to speak to individual atoms that are very close. You cannot focus your light. You want to do a Raman transition. You want to do a coherent manipulation of two qubits. Okay, you can't do it with individually if atoms are very close to one another, because you can only focus your light to the wavelength, and the wavelength is microns. The microns, so, and these are much closer than a micron. So the way to do it is to put voltage leads that do Stark shift, that change, that put all the other atoms off resonance, and only the atom you want to talk to will do the Raman transition. And there's another thing that you call the electric motor. Until now, you saw the atoms run forward with a thermal velocity, but with the BC, you don't have that. And we, with this additional degree of freedoms, we can push the atoms inside the guides. Let me... okay, two more transparencies and I'm done. Okay. This is our electric experiment that is now inside the chamber. You have here electric leads, you have a magnetic guide. This is a current carrying wire with a magnetic guide, and you have electric leads. And you really see how both potentials, the E and the B potential, are combined to make traps. I won't tell you anything about the light elements because we don't have time, and just a word about the BC, and that's it. So, the BC. Our BC experiment is just now online after a year in the boxes. And what you usually thought, what people usually thought they need for a BC is very high vacuum, 10 to the minus 12 at least. Why? Because you want to do you need a very long cooling. Very long cooling, it's called evaporative cooling. I won't go into the details, but you need a long cooling time. The reason why you need a long cooling time is because you want to have the atoms have time to collide and thermalize, re-thermalize inside the cloud. And for that, you need a long time because they're not compressed enough, so the scattering length doesn't give you enough scattering rate in a short time to thermalize. So the cooling process took tens of seconds. For that, you needed a long lifetime, and for that, you need a long vacuum, which meant you had to have a very complicated structure, as we actually have. And that is how all previous experiments were done. What has now been shown in the latest experiment is that you can do it because the atom chip enables you high compression of your atoms. The thermalization rates are much faster. The cooling rates are more than an order of magnitude faster. You can do it in a bad vacuum because of that, and you don't need this elaborate structure. You can do a much simpler vacuum chamber, and because of that, many people that have not been interested in the manipulation that we're interested in of atoms, but are just interested in BC for other reasons, are now starting to be interested in the atom chip just to easily form BCs in several hundred milliseconds. Let me conclude. So, we think and hope that we've demonstrated the principles of microfabricated atom optics. We adapted state-of-the-art fabrication to atom optics. We built and tested atom chips down to 1 micron, as I showed you. And these included traps, guides, beam splitters, and vertical traps, which can go a vertical fiber that can go everywhere on the chip. We reached a regime that is theoretically favorable for quantum processing, which is 1 megahertz and ground state sizes of 10 nanometers. And now, right now, in our chambers, we have experiments going for BC, for light cavity, for electric interaction, and for the interferometer. And there is a review paper coming out where you can really go into the details of what has been done in all the different groups. Thank you very much. Well, the technical noise, of course, comes about what it does. It vibrates your minima.
Yeah.
Okay. So nobody really knows how good you have to be. It will be a function of the height. It will be a function of what temperatures and so on. Yes, but again, I'm saying it will be a function. But if you take 10 to the minus 4, 10 to the minus 5 stability, this is what we use currently, then you can already go almost all the way. So right now, it doesn't look like that available current drivers will not be able to do the job.
You have a question what you have in mind for trying to do the kind of single qubit manipulations that one needs for doing quantum information processing. Because quite often in a standard EEC, one has to transfer into a light trap so that you can have a trap that's independent of the internal degree of freedom, so then you can make a transition between different states. But a magnetic trap is going to be extremely strongly state dependent.
Okay. First, I have to apologize to the quantum information community here because I really didn't have time to go into that, but I'd be happy to discuss it. We have a lot of stuff on that, a lot of thoughts. But a very quick answer to your question, if you take your qubits to be the hyperfine state of 2, 1, and 1 minus 1, for example, which is good for rubidium or lithium or whatever, then you see that because MF is the same, you'll get the same trapping potential for both of them. So you have a qubit which is not state dependent, and now you just have to think, in terms of the potential at least, it doesn't see different potentials, so you don't have different gradients or different barriers and so on. And now you just have to see how you do whatever you want, Raman transitions for coherent one qubit manipulation, or how you do the two qubit manipulation and so on. But I'll be happy to show you scenarios later, but it's fine.
For this calculation of the interference in the beam splitter, you only took the Schrödinger equation. There's no non-linear interaction.
That's a great question. No, these are non-interacting particles, and it's a very good approximation because if you look at the densities that we're doing with thermal cloud, the thermal cloud, the density, it's a very dilute gas. You can take that approximation. But it would be very interesting to see there are now mean field calculations about what happens, for example, coming from, Menotti et al. From Peter Zoller's group, they calculated what happens to a BC that goes into such a splitter. And because of all kinds of mean field effects, actually, they're claiming that a BC would not like to split coherently in such a beam splitter, which is totally counterintuitive, and it would be beautiful to try and see that in an experiment.
Okay.